This is not a review talk, so I can just relate some of the work done at the Maryland group with people who were in some way affiliated with Maryland. And subject-wise, actually I like to divide it into three parts. One is the early universe in the inflationary cosmology context. The other is early universe with semi-classical gravity. And with that, we would like to discuss a new regime from the semi-classical gravity up in energy scale, but before the full scale of quantum gravity, which is known as stochastic gravity or stochastic semi-classical gravity. And with that framework, I'd like to discuss some recent work on black hole back reaction. I've decided basically to neglect this part altogether, because otherwise I wouldn't have any time for some of the remaining two parts. If people would still be around in discussion session, I can say 5 minutes or 10 minutes about what's new in there. This is sort of awkward moving around, trying to avoid the watermark here and there. All right. Well, I guess I don't need to go through all these introductions. Why is non-equilibrium statistical mechanics necessary? I personally actually have a philosophical sort of viewpoint towards why this is necessary, both in terms of working out the quantum processes, which I hopefully can exemplify for you in this talk, as well as looking at both the constituent aspect, i.e. what are the basic constituents of space-time. And of course, this is really the center of string study, string theory. The rationale there is that even if you now have the truth, the true theory of the universe, which of course explains both space-time as well as matter, you still have to do some statistical mechanics in order to explain to us what goes on in this low energy phenomenology. And oftentimes I like to compare people working in general relativity as nuclear physics compared to the high energy physics, the string theory. And I think we'll be seeing more and more of those features. And in that sense, to the extent that nuclear physics is a kind of condensed metaphysics, we're doing condensed metaphysics also. But of course,
as
So, in fact, for those people who thought that they're doing elementary particle physics, the holy grail or whatever, 50 years ago, they are doing condensed metaphysics today. In other words, at every level of structure, okay, it just keeps on. There is a particular energy level whereby you can look at the basic in quotes constituents at that level. But if you move up in energy, okay, some of those features would gradually dissipate away, okay, and you would have to wait to another energy level before you can see more clearly another set of constituents with another set of laws that govern them together. So to me, there's nothing elementary, but we'll be doing both particle physics as well as condensed metaphysics, one way or the other. So anyway, I don't want to, that can be a whole hour of philosophical discussions. And many of these rationales, I think it's no need to preach to the already converted. So let me focus on take the opportunity here to discuss a little bit of the different paradigms, important paradigms, in non-equilibrium statistical mechanics. And of course that, I think, would form the basis of our theoretical foundation in the discussion here. We've heard in the past 2 days discussions of the hierarchy, the BBGKY hierarchy, for example, and different ways of truncating them, of taking the different moments or different correlation or order of correlation functions. there's still quite a bit of unresolved, well, in fact, the whole field is quite wide open as to what you would introduce in order to see what you get. Thermalization was one big issue, of course, that we have experienced in the last couple of days. So today I'd like to develop a little more time in the discussion of quantum open systems. Well, there are two ways to look at any physics problem. You can take a very idealistic way and say that, look, this is the closed system, you write down the Hamiltonian, you should be able to get everything out of it. It's just like writing down the big wave equation for everything of the universe. It's nice, but it's probably not too useful for people who are confined at a lower energy scale or who can only measure a particular range, energy range. And so from a practical viewpoint, we're always dealing with an open system. Okay? Even within the closed system, when there are different time scales involved, and if you can only measure this long, I mean 100 years if you live that long, okay, you will be destined to be observing something quite different from someone who would be able to observe the whole thing. It's about the super universe, super domain. Many of these aspects would come up in a realistic setting, especially in cosmology, of course. But before I delve into cosmology, quantum, or semi-classical, I should mention, in fact, Jim Hartle here has given a very nice discussion of keeping the universe, okay, as a closed system, and how you do quantum mechanics and make sensible deductions out of it. For us here, we just do it in the rather plain way, use the quantum Brownian motion model. But I like to introduce the influence functional method. Again, the closed time path method is, I think, elementary for everyone now. I like to take this opportunity to urge you to pay some attention to the influence functional because it has a lot of other things equally interesting and important to offer us. And specifically, it's particularly useful, at least for my own understanding, how I came to this, working on these problems, is the issue of noise and fluctuation. So that will be the central focus of these discussions here. While the rest, I actually won't have time to discuss any of those things, maybe just the last item. So let me just mention some of the problems that one could use this paradigm to address. Certainly, the decoherence via the environment or environment-induced decoherence has been a rather active topic in the past 7-8 years. And that, of course, is, I shouldn't say central, it's a necessary ingredient in the quantum to classical transition or viewing the quantum classical correspondence. Salmon has certainly devoted a lot of time in thinking about that, and there are a lot of subtle issues. Let me just put it that way. Now, what's instrumental in decohering an otherwise complete quantum system is due to the fluctuations or noise in the environment or the subsystem that the system interacts with. With nonlinear coupling, you get multiplicative noise, and in general, the color noise is almost unavoidable. That's why when you take two coupled equations and try to cast the, eliminate one and put it into the other in an honest way, you don't drop anything, you're bound to have non-local behavior in the system variable. And of course, that certainly bears on what we heard yesterday in terms of, say, the soft gluon versus the hard gluon mode. Separation and taking the back reaction of the hard sector on the soft, so on and so forth. There's a lot of common features. Just that example, I can give one corresponding example in stochastic inflation, where the high frequency modes are supposed to be the noise, the source of the noise that drives the equation for the long wavelength modes. But there, I mean, again, what enables you to write down a classical equation, okay, that's usually the starting point for most people. They write down a Langevin equation governing the long wavelength modes with a stochastic noise source. And, well, allegedly this comes from a full quantum field. If you do the division of high-low frequency, how does that come about? Again, it involves two issues. One is for the long wavelength sector, why is it classical? It has to be decohered, first of all. Okay? What makes it possible to decohere would be due to the, in this particular example, the high frequency mode. So that's noise. So again, noise, decoherence, fluctuation, they are all one and the same set of issues. And I'll show you also that by virtue of the fluctuation dissipation relation, it's also related to the dissipation in the system dynamics. Okay, so they all actually are interrelated and can indeed be obtained in some careful manner from the original closed system. This is dry enough, I hope. So. Too many things to deal with. All right. So, just to anchor ourselves, since we're going to talk about cosmology of the universe, this is the thermal history of the universe, barring some fudging from late. Since it happened in a flash, I should only show you in a flash. There it is. Okay. You all are familiar with that, so let me save some time. All right. The theoretical framework for us to do, in fact, I mean, you can see that the first day, Emil talked about one large N, and with application, the work with Kluger and his other longtime collaborators, a very good result in QED. Back reaction. Yesterday we heard about QCD and certainly back reaction, okay, from different sectors. So you know sooner or later gravity is going to come along, and here it is. Right. This is general relativity. The semi-classical gravity framework is what's used in this morning's talk, for example, in the discussion of inflation. It also, of course, is where the important discovery of Hawking radiation was made. Characteristic of this is the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor of the quantum field. Okay, taken with respect to some vacuum, which has a symmetry commensurate with the background space-time. This is kept classical. Okay. Now, right away, you would object to this. If we believe in quantum mechanics, let's say, why should this be classical at all? I mean, so presumably, in the beginning, there's got to be some wave equation governing some quantum degrees of freedom. And if we believe in quantizing gravity, then this should actually be an outcome of that quantum gravity. And again, what's important, one of the important issues in that transition is decoherence. Why should the quantum wave function have this particular preferred sort of classical condensate state as the limiting case? And that, of course, is a very important issue, because in the back of that, not the least, is the issue of time in there, okay, in quantum gravity. We're not going to touch on that. We'll start with this and just inch our way a little bit up to the quantum domain. What is, and so let me mention this and then jump to quantum gravity and cosmology. Of course, this was done in the late 60s, early 70s, and again, well, by DeWitt, Wheeler, Misner in the early wave, and in the mid 80s by Hartle, Hawking, Vilenkin, many other people in quantum gravity. In here, usually it's done in the mini superspace approximation, just picking out certain modes, low-lying modes. The homogeneous cosmology, for example, or the Bianchi cosmology, they all belong to this low-lying mode. If you use the particle, you know, viewpoint of a whole spectrum, but even there, it's difficult, you know, to have a precise definition of the spectrum, because again of the question of energy and time related. So I just want you to be aware of that epoch. The focus of this talk is more somewhere in between here. Okay, this is unavoidable. I'll try to show you that if you take this seriously, and if you take what I mentioned earlier on the statistical mechanical aspects seriously, there is bound to be a stochastic term. And I'll explain to you what the meaning of this term. In fact, this is for us who can only function at low energy. I don't know who can function at high energy. Well, there are a few groups of people who can do that. For people who can only function at low energy, this seems to be a very important clue for us to sort of pry open and look into the deeper structure of things. Now, operator product expansion and many of those things actually are related, and we're just presenting it in a statistical mechanical light. Okay, so I just want to mention this, and we will see this more clearly in some examples. All right, cosmological models we don't need. Phase transition, you all know. Galaxy formation comes later, doesn't matter. All right, so I assume that you already know everything about gut scale processes from this morning. Okay, so it's easy to motivate this by drawing the similarity. Historically, it's actually the other way around. People started, you know, looking at particle production in curved space-time, like Parker in 66, his thesis, Seldovich 1970, who proposed the parametric amplification picture for particle production. Well, but let's stick with, because every 10 years there's a new paradigm, and for old folks we need to keep on learning new things and shifting our paradigm. So this is the center of the universe now, right? Inflation. And the inflaton field is the background field, and then the decay product field, or some of the other fields, phi squared, chi squared, coupled to them, we decompose them into a background field as well as some quantum fluctuation field. And we study, like the very good review that Rich gave this morning, this field, of course, the quantum fluctuation field, is what sees the particles produced and causes free heating in the inflationary context. Here we have a background metric and a quantum field. Again, this is a rather odd combination. I should again remind you that the basic physics shouldn't be like this. The reason why this can exist in this way is because of the heavy Planck mass scale that you can actually introduce a Born-Oppenheimer approximation from your Hoyle-DeWitt equation when it comes down. And of course you have to deal with the coherence issues and so on. So now we have this as a background field, classical field. And you can make a background field decomposition. This is the perturbation, the gravitational wave perturbation. I'll invoke two examples. One is the Bianchi type 1, which is basically an anisotropic but homogeneous cosmology. But the anisotropy is can be viewed as a perturbation of the isotropic Robertson-Walker universe. The other example used by Campos and Verdiger is the inhomogeneous inhomogeneous cosmology, which contains this H mu nu. All right, now particle production, parametric amplification of chi, similarly, that of the scalar field, the quantum field in the case of semi-classical gravity. And that comes by the time dependence either of the inflaton field or the background space time, background geometry. Well, again, back reaction from particle production from an expanding universe was taken seriously, in fact, towards the end of the 70s. Again, Jim Hartle, as well as Leonard Parker, some of the prime movers in that direction. Since Rich said that, well, 70s is long history, so now it's a good chance to introduce you to some of the older folks that also carry out something similar. And in fact, for me, I learned a lot from those, this type of inquiry. concerning, of course, renormalizability, renormalization of quantum fields in curved space-time, how you can set up the problem consistently, i.e. the quantum field evolution as well as the background field, background geometry evolution, and so on. And in fact, what prompted us in proposing the CVP, okay, as a viable method was after, at least for me, a long, 6 or 7 years with the Sleban, we found out that, well, in order to do evolutionary equation, the in-out is not the right thing to do. Okay, so a lot of these basic things were indeed investigated in the semi-classical context. So I think it's good to sort of revisit some of these things and see how much we could push the frontier forward. Another reason, okay, so this is something I'm going to discuss some more about, the Einstein-Langevin equation for the G. And similarly, there should be Langevin equation for the background field. We saw a Langevin equation yesterday in this QCD context. And so I would try to mix both the theoretical framework, the conceptual framework, the formalism, as well as the physical problems, and see how, in fact, some of these problems, if you view it from a physical viewpoint, you would anticipate what type of stochastic or statistical equations. And another sort of ulterior motive for us to delve into this area of noise and fluctuation is to prepare the ground for the serious study. Okay, again, serious is a good word, right, from what we learned of critical dynamics. It's possible that from at the Planck scale, from the low energy condensate, aptly describable by the G mu nu, to the quantum gravity degrees of freedom, be it strings or other things, that it might involve phase transition or at least a crossover behavior. Okay, so the noise that comes in here is sort of a telltale sign to enable us to probe further into the other phase. Now, in saying this, I have in mind the way critical phenomena was conducted in the 50s. Okay, today, of course, all the young people will say, come on, you don't do that, you put it on the lattice. Okay, you know, find out what, you see, even thermodynamics, okay, this good old thermodynamics that we all know, actually told us quite a bit in the 50s, like the scaling laws, many of those things were deduced first in that context. Why should I do it in such a poor man's way? Because we are indeed rather poor. We are sort of confined to live in a low energy phenomenology. And so I think these are good historical lessons for us to learn in finding different ways to decipher the secrets of higher energy from only low energy means. In fact, the history of physics progressed in this way, not the other way. From time to time, there are some very smart people that could tell us that this is the theory of everything. But even so, he or she would have to come down to this lower energy in order to check some of the postulates or theories. The Bekenstein-Hawking example that generated the recent enthusiasm and breakthroughs in string theory is another example. They're just very scarce. There are very few anchors that one could really feel that the physics would have a solid foundation to sit on. All right, again, let me flash through this quickly because you all know you're experts in statistical mechanics. So this is my view of non-Euclidean statistical mechanics. The primary aim is really to select, extract, reconstitute from an infinite degree of freedom, usually just a few variables. It could be phenomenological variables, it could be collective variables, which can capture the essence of the whole system. It's a simple demand, but it's a simple statement, but a very tough demand. And if you keep this in mind, I certainly feel when you look at thermodynamics, hydrodynamics, some of these things, it marvels me that you can say so much about the system with just one concept like temperature. Okay, I said the room is very hot, right? I don't say, look, I mean, the degrees of freedom here, and it's changing, the P's and Q's and I's of all the printouts are changing. It doesn't tell us anything at all, okay? But this tells us something that we can relate on a macroscopic scale. Similarly in hydrodynamics, and again, the reason why I point these two aspects out is because I feel that general relativity really is the hydrodynamic limit of the of string theory, let's say. Okay. All right. So what we need to do is there are three steps involved. This is introducing the moving to the quantum open system framework. We have to distinguish the relevant versus the irrelevant variables, and this is oftentimes by no means trivial. Okay. We need some scale that could discern them, like in Dietrich's talk to yesterday. If you have these three regions well separated by the scale, you can do Barrett reaction, coarse graining, and do a lot of statistical rendition. But oftentimes, if you're given the full theory, it's very difficult to decide which is most relevant. And again, what you decide is relevant, and the physics that you get from there could be completely different from someone else's physics when, what he views as relevant is quite different from what you view as relevant. Then the averaging of the irrelevant variables usually is called coarse graining, and then the effect of the environment on the system. So coarse graining, Barrett reaction, they are an integral part of the scheme. Okay. Let me show you this a little bit in more detail in a schematic way. So you start with the closed system unitary quantum dynamics. You split by some physical argument, reasoning, into systems A and B. At this point, this is still unitary, and it's only until you have coarse grain one of the subsystems, thus rendering it into an environment, at least that's how I would define an environment, that you would lose unitarity. The influence functional is a very powerful way to organize, to keep track of the environment and the way how the coarse graining is being performed. And in general, you will see that the influence action, what's in the exponential, contains two parts, the noise kernel and the fluctuation, the noise or fluctuation kernel versus the dissipation kernel, these two parts. I'll show you with the QBM paradigm in slightly more detail. But schematically, it's very interesting too. I think it's important to just look at the bigger picture first.
You can switch over, right?
Sorry?
Mu and U,
I always make that mistake because there's an I in front of the S. Is that right?
Okay, but the dissipation?
It's E to the I
the
F.
Is the real part.
It's the real part in the action or in the or in the functional?
The action.
In the action. Okay, so switch mu and nu. The nu is the noise. I like to keep it that way. So let's call that mu plus I nu.
Okay.
I thought I got it right, of course I got it wrong. The important thing to realize is that with these two parts, with this new way of looking at the same problem, we actually have on this side, okay, field theory. This is what we traditionally learn in quantum field theory. Divergences, ultraviolet divergence, renormalization, all those things are carried out on this side. And in fact, if we take the back reaction calculation with the background space-time, we use the traditional Schwinger DeWitt effective action for in-out, we would get the dissipation kernel, in fact. Right? That was, of course, first done by Jim here in the late 70s. Bryce DeWitt, of course, has been advocating that all along. We only took him seriously, slowly. Now, this part is new and interesting, at least to me, when it was first discovered, and that is that, in fact, the noise kernel And the fluctuation kernel are balanced by a fluctuation dissipation relation. It's a formal relation. You know, it's there. It takes different manifestations in different circumstances, but there's such a relation. And the relation basically comes from the unitarity of the closed system. You know, when you do the split. The noise is instrumental in rendering these system variables from quantum to classical. Okay, so in there, of course, is the decoherence process, and the noise enters in this manner. So if we look at this schematically, we see that from quantum to classical, when you start from quantum, you end with classical. But this is stochastic, classical stochastic dynamics, and the stochasticity comes actually from the fluctuations in the environment, which again is precisely balanced by the dynamics, by the dissipative dynamics now the system has acquired. Okay? It's also interesting if you look at it in this way, that usually we deal with the microscopic degrees of freedom in the environment, and there is a relationship between the macroscopic variables, could be, in our case, the background space-time metric, can be related to the microscopic activities in the environment. And in this paradigm, we're treating the scalar field as the environment. So as a result, you get master equations, Fokker-Planck equations, whatever you like. But the Langevin equation is probably the most physically transparent, because here you actually see a driven force on a force damped harmonic oscillator. But the important thing is that there is now a classical stochastic source. All right. Now, that's the conceptual scheme. Let me just give you a quick rundown of the QBM paradigm that we worked on, and of course, everybody else has worked on for decades, if not centuries. Now, closed system is described by the wave function, right, and the density matrix. The propagation of the system with this full description given by the density matrix is via the propagator that relates from zero time to t time. If you don't care too much about the subsystem B, rendering it to an environment, you can carry out some coarse graining. One example is to integrate out the environmental variables. This gives one definition of a reduced density matrix. The task here is basically, how do you find the propagator for the reduced density matrix? Okay, so you write down the Feynman path integral representation. You put all the terms back in there. You want the propagator for the reduced density matrix that propagates it from time zero to time t. Okay, written in this form with the path integral representation, you have the influence functional there, given as follows. This was, of course, first introduced by Feynman-Vernon and made very popular by Cotterill-Leggett, mainly in the condensed metaphysics circle in the beginning, and now everybody knows, and even called this Cotterill-Leggett model. Okay, I'll tell you that this is rather inappropriate, because this actually corresponds, what they have done really is the Markovian segment of that, but never mind about that. The harmonic oscillator belongs to everyone, so. Some people even claim the ownership for things they cannot solve or they don't even understand. So the Brownian motion is very simple again. It's a simple single oscillator, an environment of n oscillators, and the bilinear coupling is what simplifies most of the things here. And if we assume that initially the bath is in the thermal equilibrium, you can write down the environment density matrix in that form. Notice that, of course, since each oscillator contributes independent of the others, it's a simple product. All right, so much for that. What I really want to show you is just the form, generic form of the influence functional, the dissipation kernel and the noise kernel. It's characteristically sandwiched between the minus and the plus, and the minus minus here. Okay. And for harmonic oscillator bath, you still have to stipulate the spectral density function, okay, density of state and so on and so forth. And there's some confusion in the literature. They think that for fields, you can do the same thing. That's actually not quite true. For example, in here, you can choose ohmic, super ohmic, sub ohmic, and they will have very different characteristic behaviors insofar as the coherence is concerned. Yeah.
A couple of technical stuff. One is that you have a MOSFET, and there's a diffusion center in MOSFET, but it's actually fairly complicated. It's time dependent. The damping term is also time dependent. You don't really have a C number Langevin equation necessarily, which is easy to solve. Right?
You're saying after this?
In general, for some nonlinear problems. So it's not obvious whether the Langevin idea is actually helpful, because usually stochastic equations are easy to solve if the noise is Gaussian and white. If it's not, then they're hopeless.
Oh, from a computational viewpoint.
Well, right. So what I'm saying is, are you saying that we should use Langevin equations, even arbitrarily complicated ones?
Well, again, depending on whether you're looking at it from a computational versatility, viability viewpoint. For here, it's really just for me a way to illustrate the concepts here.
Okay. Okay, that brings me to my second point. In completely linear systems like this, there's no need to use the inference.
Right. Salmon has written a series of papers on this point. I'm telling everybody knows everything.
This is an important point.
It is.
This paper is actually only one paper. It was not written by me, Jim Anglin. And the point is very simple. For linear systems, no fancy calculations are needed. It's like But for nonlinear systems, when you start using perturbation theory and doing calculations, Larry's worry about what happens at base times becomes very important. So I have no clue what happens with these Langevin and Poisson descriptions when the problem becomes serious. I mean, you really have to think about it.
Well, we're glad we wrote the second paper, after the first one, which addresses nonlinear couplings and to render it slightly non-trivial. The meaning of the noise kernel is quite interesting. Okay, the whole game here, so to speak. Okay, for me, really is. This is the gist of the matter. Okay, why is that? Because here we are honest, we want to be honest, and take the field theory and everything carries out from first principle. Okay, we keep track of what's being coarse grained away, what's being integrated away, and do that. Now, why should we suddenly, have to deal with noise, such an ugly thing, right? As you know, whenever there's a noise term, you put in by hand. That's always done that way. Okay, I want to find out that. Well, is there a way that we can do it without putting it by hand? And in fact, we're led to sort of the rediscovery, belatedly, of Feynman Werner's work, and even some of the footnotes are very illuminating. So let me just show you. This is really just a trick. It's a Gaussian functional integral identity. Remember this term from the previous slide, the noise kernel. You can use this functional identity to rephrase this in terms of a distribution average of a stochastic variable C. Okay, this is exact. This is a mathematical identity. Okay, of course you can. You can choose to think of it in the original way. Okay, or you can think of it now as if that the system is now subjected to a stochastic noise source arising from the environment. And it's here that you can see the Langevin equation or that philosophy taking root. So here we have two averages. One is the average over the noise distribution, which really serves to incorporate this contribution of this term in the influence functional. This is the real part, right? So, and of course, earlier we also have the quantum average over the reduced density matrix. Okay, and we haven't done anything, done any violence to it, or if there is any approximation, at least everything is on the table. And indeed, you get an equation like this. This is to explain the meaning of the dissipation kernel. Why is it that we call this particular mathematical quantity dissipation and the other one noise? That previous one explains the noise. And if you do, if you go to the center of mass coordinate, the equation of motion takes indeed this Langevin form. Okay. All right. Boy. Impossible to cover. So from this point on, since now you're all experts of coarse graining, I'm going to also give the talk in a very coarse grained way. I'll give you first an example, the example that led us to this understanding, that of the semi-classical Einstein equation. Well, again, the gravitational classical background field, the Jimmy Neal description, and then the quantum scalar field. And we need to solve this self-consistently, these two equations self-consistently. This was done sort of from 1977-78 on all the way. let me just covering everything in full, just give you the example of the in out. This is the vacuum persistence amplitude, effective action, and certainly you can calculate the particle production amplitude. This is the probability amplitude for the initial vacuum to remain as the same at a later time. So it's a measure of vacuum instability, and as all of you now know, that this type of question, this formalism is particularly apt to the questions like the calculation of S matrix or the transition amplitudes, but not quite suitable for the questions involving evolution. For that, we need to go to the in-in. That is prehistory, so let me skip all of that. And since this is a statistical mechanics conference, there shouldn't be any apology to, doesn't need any apology to look at the damped harmonic oscillator equation. This is what you'll get. I've recast the variable. In this case, what we studied was the Bianchi type 1. As I mentioned earlier, you can treat that as a perturbation. The interesting term is this one. Here, this is the K is the non-local dissipation kernel. This arises from the back reaction of the quantum field on the background space-time. All right. Well, why should there be such a term? Okay. That was the question that sort of beset me in particular. I just didn't give up. And there was some indication that there is, should be some term like that. It's basically just an indication, because as Seban in our paper, 87 paper, we look at the viscosity function here, okay, the dissipation, and indeed they balance very nicely. The power dissipated, okay, in the dissipation, the viscosity function, right? So just think about this as a damped harmonic oscillator. In freshman physics, we teach students how to do that. You integrate the power and get the energy dissipation from the viscosity function. But that energy, of course, should be balanced by the particles produced. So particle production, the energy should balance those two. And so, but that's basically just an energy balance. Why should there be a statistical or stochastic term? Okay. So that question was led us to the next stage of investigation. And to make a long story short, what we found out that is, in fact, there should be such a term there, and that forces one into a larger conceptual framework, i.e. one should actually start with a discussion of the density matrix of the universe. This was actually proposed in 1980, early 1980s, by Stephen Hawking, Don Page, and a number of people working in quantum gravity. And they call the S matrix, relating density matrix of the universe, the dollar sign. Well, what else is more appropriate than the dollar sign? The density matrix, and you have system environment split, Okay. Larry.
Maybe I was linked at the wrong time.
You don't like the dollar sign.
I'm saying too many frameworks and I'm losing the problem.
Okay.
What's the problem?
The problem? We're trying to calculate everything in the universe, like the wave function of the universe. I mean, this is even more serious. It's the density matrix of the universe. No. Okay. Some people try to do that. Okay. Ours is a more modest aim. Okay. I just want. I haven't done anything yet, so it's certainly very modest. Okay.
Everything is now on the horizon.
No, that's Rich's problem. Okay. Everything's out of our sight, in fact. The main thing I'd like to point out is that there is a stochastic regime beyond semi-classical gravity. Okay. That enters in the discussion of galaxy formation, structure formation. There will be these noise terms in there, in the field theory aspect. It enters also in black hole horizon fluctuations, which is a very important issue, okay, concerning information and, you know, collapse and all those, okay. And this is a viable way, and to me the best way to approach that sort of problems. You have to wait 10 minutes before I get to the physics part. Yeah. Sorry about that, because nobody else has talked about open system and influence functional before this point. Otherwise, it could have saved a whole hour. Looks like this is too grandiose a scheme, so let me skip it. All right. Let's get to something calculable. Again, it depends on what you find as reasonably calculable. How about starting from the wave function of the universe, Larry? No, I want to show you that these are all doable. It's not just empty words and big words, okay? You can, of course, but there are several crucial steps one has to pay close attention to, like decoherence. Okay, but then the question is, what's the source of decoherence, the noise? Where does the noise come from? Comes from the quantum field. If you have two sectors, okay, like this is usually done in quantum cosmology, you have a system, which is the mini superspace. The reason why it's mini is because you just take a few low-lying modes, okay? And, well, certainly Robson Walker is just m equal to 1, Bianchi 1 is m equal to 3, so on and so forth. Inhomogeneous cosmology, much bigger, but they have to truncate it anyway. And you take the scalar field as the environment. The justification I mentioned earlier arises from the fact that the Planck mass is really heavy. That enables you to do the Born-Oppenheimer separation, which is pretty much like the slow, fast, the heavy, the light. We need that sort of thing, you know, to start doing.
You also rely on the fineness being heavy to basically neglect higher curvature or any modification of Fine-Condell?
We need those higher curvature corrections for the reason you said this morning, because of the realizability of the team you knew. That's right. So even we pretend to be innocent and modest, okay, like we just want the G mu nu, right? Once you put in the T mu nu, it forces you to introduce these higher curvature terms. Yes, so they are there. They are all there. But with respect to the really high energy physics people, this is really low energy stuff. Okay? And of course, they have to explain it, and we also share the burden to explain how a quantum theory description can end up as semi-classical. Yes.
There's a Planck scale.
Yeah.
What energy regime are you working in? I mean,
I'm working in the energy regime of the Planck scale. And if you approach it from below, you can safely use Einstein's theory, really low below. And when you move close to the Planck scale, you will see particle production coming out copiously. Okay? That's the point that you need to begin to take into consideration back reaction. Okay, and what I'm saying here is the back reaction in semi-classical gravity is an old subject matter for 20 years. What I'm saying here is that actually amongst the back reaction, there's a very important ingredient in it, which is the stochastic aspect of that. Okay.
I guess the worry I have, and it's probably not germane totally, but if you're at that level, I mean, if you're past just semi-classical and you're trying to really incorporate some back reaction, why don't you all of a sudden have to jump to the full theory of gravity with everything?
I can't.
Well, I know you can't, but I mean, why is there a regime of validity?
The regime of validity is near the Planck scale, approaching from below. It's very precise. Yeah. And in fact, we still have these, no, we still have these collective modes that we have to deal with, describable by Jeannie and you. Okay? We don't have any string degrees of freedom as yet. Okay? On the other hand, if you work in string theory, at some point you have to show us how the condensate or the collective mode come into being. Okay? So this is sort of a crossroad that I can see lots of people would have to deal with, either from high up or from below.
Just one last time. Mm-hmm. There must be a separate, so if you believe in string theory, there must then be, in your mind, a separation between somehow a stringy scale.
Yes.
Where it's fully stringy physics.
Oh, yeah.
And it's black mass.
Oh, yeah.
The, is there a relatively large separation if you're going to be trusting any of this in any real extent, right?
Oh, or the other thing, too. I mean, depending on how low you push the scale down, yeah. Right. So there's a scale that we have to exchange currency. I mean, it's a different set of variables, I believe, okay? And I think in string theory, it's increasingly showing that, that graviton is not just quantized G mu nu, it comes out as sort of the low-energy condensate. So even involving solid tonic structures, this is not as interesting as questions, so let me skip all this. I just want you to be aware of the fact that, indeed, it is doable. That you can start with, let's say, quantum cosmology, which really is, of course, a truncated version of quantum gravity, and come down to semi-classical gravity. The crucial thing, everybody knows about that. What I'm saying is that if you come down, you will necessarily obtain a stochastic element in it. That is new, okay? Nothing else is new.
The truth theory and where you can believe in quantum gravity but with Einstein gravity, between integrating that out is what's driving the production of stochastic type of time.
In fact, for our purpose, just forget about strings. We're not seeing string degree of freedom whatsoever. Okay, these are excitations, basically, if you could think about, of the collective mode. And amongst them, there are perturbations versus fluctuations. I'll come to this conceptual point. It's a very important conceptual point that needs clarification before one can move any further. All right. I shouldn't skip too much. If you do this, okay, do it well and honestly. Honesty is a little golden word. You actually get this equation. Well, you did it in the right term, right in that equation. You smeared it. No, it's right there. So what smeared should actually be this term rather than that term. Okay, this term is the stochastic term. And in fact, if you do the noise average, you get the semi-classical Einstein equation. Good try, though. All right. It's in here. All right. Anyway, I think Sukanya Sinha, one of my former students, did this with me together with Matash, Andrew, and Esteban, of course. But I think a beautiful piece of work I always want to relate to you is that done by Campos and Vertiga. In fact, they took the trouble of putting everything covariant. They start with this weakly inhomogeneous cosmology, so you see this H mu nu there. It's essentially the same as the anisotropic, weakly anisotropic Bianchi type 1 calculation that Jim and I started some time ago. But I'd like to show you the noise kernel. Okay. Now, I assume that you already know how to get the noise from the QBM, right? Of course, right. So this is the effective action, the influence action, I should say, and you still vaguely remember this form, and the noise kernel. And after that, you can put this all in. Well, this is the Weyl curvature, highly reduced. The C plus C minus is the CDP index. And it's coupled to this. This is, of course, expected, because what is giving rise to particle production in this class of space-time is really the departure from conformal flatness, either by anisotropy or by inhomogeneity. And that's why this is sort of the source term, right, driving your coordinate.
This is
free field, yes. Well, just want you to take a look at this. Well, of course, what else could it be? It's constructed by these...
Are they harmonic?
What? What now?
No. So doesn't this thing have very, very bad ultraviolet properties?
No.
No.
if that's your rationale, okay. The answer is even bigger no. Because as I mentioned in passing, all right, I don't have time to go through the whole 10 years of renormalization things in quantum field in curve space time. That happens actually on the right hand, on the left hand side. Remember, on this side we have noise and fluctuation, on that side we have that ultraviolet divergences. And this generalized formalism still contains that part which contains the divergences, and the same routine that you use to cure those divergences still remaining here. Okay. As you will see, actually, we are probing into the statistical mechanical content, okay, of the field theory here. But since it is a self-consistent back reaction scheme, we are also probing, the hope is that we're by means of probing into the statistical properties of the field, we can also probe into the excitations of the gravitational sector.
I was completely confused. Let me ask a question. So suppose you were doing a calculation in some controlled approximation, like large M, right?
The question should be there.
But you know, or some class of mean field theory. Then let's say homogeneous mean field. So then we have mean fields that are homogeneous, and we have inhomogeneous fluctuations.
Mm-hmm.
So what all of us do is we just say, oh yeah, these are complicated equations for the most couple of the mean fields. We just put them on the computer and solve the whole thing. But you don't have to do that. You can then say, because there is a Hamiltonian in mean field theory for the whole system. And that Hamiltonian consists of a mean field part, the fluctuation and interaction
mm-hmm.
part. In
mm-hmm.
fact, it looks like a slightly nonlinear generalization of the independent oscillator model. So are you saying that if that equation, if I average over the fluctuation in mean field theory, then I'll get a reduced density matrix describing the evolution of
uh-huh.
the mean field? Is
okay.
that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying that in the context of 1 over n. I'm not saying that in the context of 1 over n. I'd like to see that actually coming out, okay? We have done... We start with an open system. Somebody else said it, okay? I always say things very carefully, right? Now, we start with an open system, so it's very clear what we are coarse-graining away. Right, but the same paradigm can be applied to closed or effectively closed system. And that's something that Stephen and I have been thinking for a number of years, and that is, for example, if you take a closed system, a BBGKY hierarchy, would you still be able to come up with a noise related to the higher correlation?
Sure, no, but you don't have to do that. I'm saying even in mean field theory, where you have truncated,
yes.
you write a reduced density matrix equation
mm-hmm.
for just the mean field,
mm-hmm.
it will be a master equation. There will be a noise.
That's right. We believe there will be such things. If you take into account the back reaction of the coarse-grained component, you'll see noise appearing in your system.
Yeah, and in fact, that's perfectly sensible, but I'm just asking, is that what you're doing? That's what I'm asking. I don't understand.
Oh, no, the paradigm is the same, but we choose a model which is very clearly separated with the system and the environment, right? And you have to deal with large N. I mean, if you account higher order, and if you do it in a reasonable coarse-graining scheme, all right, I believe that you will be able to see features like that also. But, you know, even the next leading order hasn't been quite worked out in detail. So that's why this is really a conceptual scheme that I'm presenting to you. All right, so the Einstein-Langevin equation for this type of cosmology, weakly inhomogeneous cosmology, worked out by Campos and Vertigo in 96, comes in this form. Now, Rich, you should be happy here now. We have all the high derivatives, as it should be. Many people who work in quantum field theory in curve space time, we have to bear with those. They're good, yes, as you said, because that comes from the renormalization of TMU nu. What is new here is this term and that term. And this is actually newer than that term, okay? In the 70s, sort of, we know about all these, okay? With the back reaction calculation, with the in-out scheme, we get the dissipation kernel also. It's only in the CTP that we found out that, well, it's there that we get a real and a causal equation of motion. Then further, if you take this enlarged framework of the Feynman-Vernon scheme, you would actually see the stochastic source term arising from there. And when we went through this influence functional scheme and found out this, because, you know, in fact, I found it easier because the influence functional has a clearer statistical mechanical meaning. Okay, then we went back, Esteban and I, to the CTP work, and we find out that actually you can just decipher it from there and you get the noise term. But I have to warn that Morikawa and Gleiser, some people, they just basically took the imaginary term in there and call it a noise term. It's wrong because it doesn't obey the fluctuation dissipation relation. Okay. Because there are people following that route, and it might be good to say that early.
Yeah, I still believe you can regularize those equations because now you have an inhomogeneous.
This is already regularized. What do you mean?
Because you can't use adiabatic methods out of FRW, and this is supposed to.
No. I'm not even choosing any FRW or any adiabatic scheme.
Yeah, that's what
This is a general framework of semi-classical gravity. You're welcome to use adiabatic up to a point, and usually those are not covariant.
No, these
people didn't use adiabatic. You said you're going to use adiabatic.
No, I said no one has succeeded in controlling equations like this outside of FRW. Even with anisotropies, you have trouble. So I'm just asking, how are you going to do the evolution?
Let me go back to 20 years ago in the paper Jim and I wrote. It was dimensional regularization. You can also show that you can come up with these terms. Are you asking me about this new term? Or what?
I think that's what someone is worried about.
That what?
The adding stochastic term.
Yes.
Will change the ultraviolet properties.
No. This actually, I'm learning Salman's mode of response. No. It's everything simple. That's one important thing I learned from Salman, yes.
How to say no?
All right, anyway. So this is the part that we would like to take as the initial point in charting the stochastic domain. Okay, so here I want to point out the conceptual distinction between a metric perturbation, which exists in classical space-time, of course. That's how we first learned this before we went to quantum things. And that of stochastic nature. Okay, in the rush of responding to Salman's question, right, I forgot to tell you the most important line here, which is the structure of the Einstein-Langevin equation. Okay, now here are the higher curvature terms, and that is the stochastic noise source term. So we have the classical, of course. This is Einstein general relativity, this is semi-classical gravity, and this is stochastic semi-classical gravity. Okay. The noise average of this term goes away, and so that's why in this sense that we call semi-classical gravity a mean field theory. Mean field with respect to the noise distribution. Okay. Now, the fluctuation, okay, that enters into here will be governed by an equation derived from the earlier equation and takes this form. Alright, so what we have is the H mu nu classical plus a stochastic H mu nu, also classical, because this is after the baptism of decoherence that all the quantum fields are now classical. And in fact, the stochastic source shows up as origin of the source's quantum field related to particle production. Okay, so the new feature is that we now have a classical equation governing the stochastic components, and this, I think, is the right thing to do in asking questions concerning metric fluctuations. Of course, the reason why I mentioned this is because Wheeler in 1962 or even earlier proposed this very beautiful notion of space-time form. and metric fluctuations. And of course, being Wheeler, he doesn't need to go through all these calculations. A few wiggles, he got the answers out bidimensional arguments. And we expect at this threshold that the metric fluctuations will begin to play an increasing role. That's the new element in this scheme.
Okay, but why at that threshold? Why would you think that you just went directly into the new degrees, more basic degrees of freedom?
Yeah, it's something that we need to have a long discussion with our string theorist colleagues. I think both I, as well as they, most of them, would not believe that it's a simple G mu nu that gets introduced into the palace, the marble palace of string theory. You need string degrees of freedom. Okay, and it's only in some particular arrangement and setup that you will begin to see the GR features coming out.
But I'm still confused. Why, by the time that you're saying that your GMU is foamy, by the time the geometry is foamy, why isn't the geometry stringy, in fact, and you have to go directly to the full theory?
Well, yes, I think it's foamy. It's stringy, okay? So the string theorists would have to come up with the space-time foam structure at some point. Now, they have more important things to do now, right? Because you have the Bekenstein-Hawking and the D-brains, all those things. It's a very important discovery that they could actually count the internal degrees of freedom, right, of a black hole. And, they should do that, right? But at some point, I think after they've sorted out all the more important theories of high-energy physics, they will come down. That's why I said we're doing nuclear physics. I've heard statements from, particle physicists saying that nuclear physicists... Oh boy, I forgot. Everything is fine, okay. This get carried away.
Make a comment.
Yes.
I don't think the Stewart going to the HBU is what someone will call a mean field. I mean, that HBU. It's not the expectation value of some Heisenberg HVU.
Yeah.
It's more interested in continuous measurement theory. If you were able to measure, in this case you can't measure HVU, but suppose it's an observable field. Suppose that you have detectors around space-time measuring the field.
Yeah.
You're not going to measure the mean field, but it's a greater string of numbers.
Yeah.
But if you knew...
So it's like a quantum trajectory, that's what it is.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And that's actually a crucial conceptual difference from our calculation of the galaxy.
Introduces even more sort of, monkey...
Compared to the existing... Yeah. Yeah. Whether you can actually play God and look at all the ensembles, everything happening to you, and you do the average, or just be humble and live our, mundane life and our world trajectory, and calculate the physics you can observe there. It's a difference between the quantum trajectory viewpoint and the ensemble average viewpoint, let's say in quantum optics, and so on and so forth. So, all right, this is only half of my talk, but anyway. All right, so let me at least try to finish this part. Black hole we can throw away because they're all smeared out. Transparency. All right, it also depends on what Emil wants us to do after I finish.
Your transparency.
So now I have extra time, but no transparency. All right, so. The crucial thing here now, again, is the fluctuation of the T mu nu, okay, above the average value, okay? You soon see that we're not doing anything so crazy. I mean, it's just like when you look at the phase transition or critical point, these are the quantities of great value or physical value, okay? Now I'll explain more to you as we move along. And they come in. And they show up in the noise kernel. Okay, so the gist of the matter now would be focused on calculating the noise kernel, or in this case, you can see that it's actually the anti-commutator of the fluctuations in the T mu nu. Okay, and they have very nice properties. This slide, by the way, is from Ulrich Verdiger, and Larry Ford and his student. And Nicholas Phillips, who's about to finish his PhD, have asserted that, in fact, the fluctuation of the T mu nu could be sizable in semi-classical gravity. Okay, so one has to be very careful about the domain of validity of semi-classical gravity.
Do you have some scale in mind when you say something like that?
Yes.
I mean,
very good. Right. Yes. Right. So there is some. There's a denominator there. Okay. One is big. In other words, you can't think of them as fluctuations anymore. And these numbers are very precious. It took a whole year to calculate. For the first case, I should say, is for our d cross S1, where d is equal to 3, which includes, of course, the finite temperature field theory in the Euclidean sense. And the second case is the Einstein universe.
What exactly is the significance?
The significance comes next, or even earlier, i.e. that the fluctuation of the T mu nu is actually a good discriminator in how good the low energy theory is.
I'm still just trying to understand what you mean when you say that. T mu nu measured at a point, T mu nu measured average over what?
This is when you take the points together, coincidence limit.
So this is a local quantity.
It's a local quantity, okay? But we started out actually calculating two-point functions, okay, of T mu nu, all right? But we have to take the coincidence limit, do all the things about regularization. You have it there in the second order, in order to come to these statements. And these statements are actually it's not specifically this point versus that point. It has to do with the topology.
Any quantum field
you would diverge.
Take the coincidence limit of the T mu nu correlator at infinity.
No, this is the T mu nu two-point function, right? Defined at two separate points.
Okay.
And of course you'll get finite results.
As long as they're separate points.
As long as they're separate, yeah. And when you bring them to two points together, they will diverge.
Right. Okay.
But if you do the regularization in the same way that you do for the T mu nu, okay, dimensional regularization, zeta function were the two tried out, okay, you'll get a finite quantity. Well, we didn't know that whether it's finite or not, or we don't even know what, you know, magnitude it will come out. Okay. It turned out to be finite, but of the order of one.
You're adding and adjusting local counter terms to the T mu nu correlator in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably the ways that it satisfies, so that it really is the second variation.
That's right. It gives the perfect first variation result that we learned in the 70s. Okay, those prescriptions are used to do the second variation of the effective action. Correct. Now, actually, we have a lot to discuss, because what I'll show later is that this quantity, just like the current-current correlation function, would actually have a lot of good physics in it. Okay. Maybe we can postpone whatever puzzle towards the next hour.
You know, once you have this definition, no matter what you do, you become extremely sensitive to the extreme shortest distance. That's really what you want to have. And just, I mean, if you smooth your quantity, you
right, then you're fine. Then you're fine. Okay.
Well.
That's right, that's right. That's why we start out with point-separated results. And in fact, I kept telling my students that Christensen and DeWitt in the mid-70s, they did the heroic, you know, piece of work of calculating all those things at two-point separated. But what people made use of those, you know, glorious, you know, detail was put the points together and try to throw them away, throw some divergence away. Of course, we need to do that. But I think the statistical information in the field, in the two-point function, well, you're the right person, of course, are very precious. And they will tell us a lot more beyond the regularized team union. And that actually goes hand in hand with the stochastic program, because it really rests on the correlation functions of the team union. But because of the self-consistency in the gravity sector with the quantum field sector, the hope is that we can use those to probe into the excitations of the gravitational. All right, so I don't know whether you guys want a break or not. After I finish this, you can decide. The remaining part would be black holes, and if I want to do it, it probably takes 15, 20 minutes. If not, we can all go out. To
Larry
and Salman.
No one's cutting you off, so you can continue on regular.
But not divergent. But not divergent. Oh boy, so fun, yes. Spilling things, throwing things at people, yes. Regularizing people. All right, so just schematically, again, concept is what I really want to get across here. Let's compare semi-classical versus quantum versus this stochastic gravity and see what are we doing? Are these for real? And are we moving somewhere, probing something physical? Physical is the key word, right? Semi-classical, as we see, this is courtesy of Weddinger, with his model of a perturbed age against the background. So you all have seen this equation, the semi-classical equation. So the age, of course, you solve this, you get this solution schematically. And the H1, H2, the correlation, will be given by the product of the mean. And we know it's not sufficient, okay? Something is missing. In the quantum equation, these are Heisenberg operators, of course. And if you take the H1, H2 operators, okay, and take the quantum average, in order to compare, of course, you have to come down and compare it with the classical value. You see it's the TT operator. What's missing between these two, of course, is the correlation, all right? That is what is filled in by the stochastic gravity. The slide I didn't show you in detail, but the tau is basically the variance of the T mu nu, okay? The two-point, the T mu nu two-point function, okay, is given by T1, T2 in here. So now this is the stochastic equation, semi-classical Einstein equation or the Einstein-Langevin equation. This term here, what is it? What function does it serve? Yeah.
I'm confused again. Sorry. If I were to do mean field theory, I would have said the expected t that you have is really the t coming from phi, from expected phi, and all the fluctuations are in another part, which I would have thought your noise is supposed to represent. But now you guys tell me no, that this is something else. This is coming from some quantum trajectory like argument, in which case you have put in some sort of selection on a usually non-selective master equation. So how do you get these particular trajectories? What measurement process?
No, I still from the beginning invoked the noise distribution. Okay.
Where does it come from? In quantum optics, it comes precisely from the type of measurements you're making, homodyne, heterodyne, whatever.
Yeah.
And here, you have no clue. What measurements are we making?
If you are functioning from a mean field, right, then all those things would have been averaged and come up as an overall effect through this noise term. Okay. Right. Let's forget about the quantum trajectory for now. Okay, and stick with the distribution function of the noise distribution. Okay, then this is no different from what I showed you 2-3 transparencies ago. Okay, what I'd like to show you is the cross term. Okay, you can actually follow this and take H1, H2, take now with regard to the noise average. So the noise average, or stochastic average, is now playing the role of a quantum average with regard to some variables that you would not otherwise carry out with regard to the semi-classical. So if you look at this, multiplying these two, the cross term here, when you take the noise average, that drops out by virtue of this first relation. The second relation here, the noise average of the correlator, okay, of the noise correlator, would be given by T1, T2, minus T1, T2, and that these two terms drop out, and you will be left with TT. In exactly the same form as in quantum, when you do a quantum average with respect to these two operators, the H1, H2, except we know the answer already, because here it's only average over the noise from the quantum fluctuations of the matter sector. Okay? You still have, of course, to go to quantum gravity in order to get the quantum fluctuations of the gravitational sector. Okay? So we only have that, so to speak. We have worked hard enough to extract the statistical information in the field sector. Okay? But what if you look at this equation, what this tells you is that it will force some interesting physics out of the H, which of course now is the metric fluctuation. So everything is actually consistent to this level also. Are you ready for a black hole, 15 minutes, or you want to take a break of 5 minutes?
Well, coffee and cookies come at 3:15, so it'd probably be better to finish up.
To finish up?
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. That's my suggestion.
You're awake?
Yeah.
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
Sorry. I would like to try to ask a question.
Mm-hmm.
And just for those of us who are practitioners of these other arts.
Yes.
We're stuck, you know, at leading order large end, but
yes.
let's not get stuck on that. Let's think about, imagine anyway, our being.
In fact, let me add one comment.
We can do other more robust approximations,
scattering
higher orders.
I'd like to see that.
Comes to be.
Mm-hmm.
What I would like to understand is just what your point of view is on the following. If you do some dynamical truncation, eventually you're going to have to do some truncation.
Uh-huh.
Where you have all kinds of higher point functions, fluctuations included in the dynamical evolution.
Uh-huh.
Are you then telling me that on top of that, I need to add again some stochastic sources?
No.
It's
from the higher
description of what I already have.
Yes.
The latter. It's not, I think.
You don't add it in by hand. But you.
I don't know.
Let's leave that discussion to a later time.
At the moment, you know, we are stuck with what's been done in leading order, part 3 of 1 of that. So I don't want to be misled by whatever.
No.
But can I ask the question in that context? So
yes.
We have a certain set of fluctuating modes, which dynamically back react on the mean field.
Mm-hmm.
We're solving some closed set of equations, which, you know, called mean field equations.
Yes.
They also have the fluctuation being followed down.
Right.
Now, at that level, would you advocate us putting, again, on top of that, stochastic noise? Or would you tell me that the fluctuations are acting as the stochastic noise, which you are describing in the CGT a different way?
Let's clarify the terminology first.
Can I understand that one?
Yes, it's a very relevant question.
Okay.
In fact, let me add on the weight of that question in this context, because Hartle and Horowitz and other people have shown that in fact this semi-classical gravity is equivalent to a leading 1 over n large n approximation with many fields in there. And in fact you can see from your equation, you know, Kluger and many of those things, it's exactly the same. The particles produced from the fluctuations of the scalar field with regard to the mean field, it's just like the same.
Having that evolution, and then entitled to go and calculate auxiliary quantities,
yes,
such as TT correlated.
Yes.
If I so desire.
Right.
And so are those the quantities you're talking about?
I would love to see.
Do I have to add something?
No.
Okay.
The whole motto here is that you should never add anything by hand, right? You just have to be careful and honest, right? Those are the two words passed on to me from the last 2 days. Okay.
I'll sign any document.
Good. All right. So, you should never put in anything by hand. So everything should actually come out from there. In fact, I would love to see someone in the 1 over n camp, okay, come up with the next leading order description of semi-classical gravity. That was what I suggested to Paul
in
one email.
Are you telling me I need to add
the next leading order one of them in order to see what you call the fluctuations?
I think
I can do influence functional CTP, all of these things within the leading order.
Sure.
And I have also
you would have
to make that change of variable.
That's right.
Have this mathematical identity.
That's right.
Right.
Yes.
And there is the stochastic.
Yeah.
So is it a different description of the same physics?
I skip one step in my response to you. I said I would love to see that, but I think that you can do this and it will come out exactly the same. What you just described.
Okay.
Because the large N, the leading one over N, gives you indeed the exact semi-classical gravity theory. Okay? If you go to the influence functional, go through this song and dance, you will probably get the stochastic terms exactly the same. It just saw no dance. In there, yeah. But then after that, after you guys have done that, I would love to see what the next to leading order. Why is that? Because of the correlation. The correlation will really show its life at that stage. So I'm still hoping to hear more from you, Lewis. Yeah. All right. Emil said that it would be interesting to talk about black holes, and Paul is here, so at least just for these two members of the audience, I should go through this. No, just stop me at any point. I'm happy to quit.
The issue with the upper cutoff really is people should go to coffee.
Of course, yeah. I will be the first one to go. All right, okay. So let's take this. It's very apt, yes, no more fluctuations. All right, so let's take this TMU new fluctuation and see what we can do with cosmology, early universe, as well as black holes. In fact, we have done something in the early universe in terms of structure formation, Esteban and I and Andrew Matash, and we took the coarse graining, the Bragg reaction, and the decoherence very seriously, okay, and we got a result which is different from everybody else's. I won't talk about that. And everybody else thinks it's wrong. Okay. I won't say anything more. Except to emphasize that we took those three aspects very seriously. Let me repeat it again. The Bragg reaction, the coarse graining, the noise, the Bragg reaction, and the decoherence. Okay. I wouldn't say what serious mean.
They're more likely everybody else doesn't understand.
Yeah. I think there are reasons. I don't want to get into it, especially since Alexei is not here. I think that coarse graining is cheating. That decoherence is cheating. But we've discussed those things. But let me not. I'd rather talk on some topic where there's somebody that could. Fight back, right? In addition to Salmon. We had fun for 3 years doing that, so no problem. All right, so black hole fluctuations then. This is a serious topic, okay? All right. First of all, again, let me make the distinction between metric perturbation and fluctuation. There are really good people doing really good work, okay? So I don't want people to get confused about terminology. Larry Ford has been pursuing this program quite similar to ours. He's been looking at the two-point function, the graviton two-point function. What happens at the light cone near the horizon and in cosmological horizon, a particle horizon, and so on. Okay, and so there's no Bragg reaction. It's basically H mu nu H rho sigma XX prime. Whereas our metric fluctuation, as I've shown you, is actually a four-point function because it's a two-point function for T mu nu. And in fact, we think that it is the physically meaningful quantity to look at in order to probe into the correlation aspects of it. And these are induced by quantum field fluctuations, and they measure the difference of particle creations in neighboring histories. This is sort of stealing a little bit of the decoherent history conceptual scheme. And certainly they come from Bragg reaction in a self-consistent manner. Okay? So it's related to the noise from quantum fields. It's a stress energy two-point function or graviton four-point function. it's a stochastic classical quantity which appears in the Einstein-Langevin equation, and it enters into the fluctuation-dissipation relation discrete. Yeah, Larry?
Trivial, but I don't understand your four-point function.
Because T mu nu is a two-point function itself.
But the T mu nu correlator is essentially the self-energy for the graviton propagator.
We'll come to that. Yes. There's a real part and the imaginary part, the polarizability tensor and all those. There are people who've been working on that also. All right. Let me not jump. Okay. So what's wrong with that? So people have done that. We're doing that. And.
I'm not saying anything.
Okay.
I didn't say anything that was related to a four-point function.
Oh, the structure is of phi. 5555, I mean, or the H.
In terms of phi, not in terms of the metric. Anyway, ignore it.
Okay, but the T mu nu is constructed from the H mu nu. In this way of the G plus H perturbation, if you like. Yeah. All right, so back to Hawking, 75. This is the equation that Stephen sort of very laboriously derived, a very important result, of course, that the mass of the black hole changes in time proportional to 1 over m squared. Okay? And the Hawking temperature is, of course, 1 over 8 pi mt. This 8 pi, that number is also very important. Okay? The semi-classical Bragg reaction has been attempted by many people. Candelas, Howard since the 80s, York certainly, I'll show that in the next transparency, and Anderson, Hitchcock, I think have probably done the most thorough work on the subject. I want to start with this dynamical situation because that was originally what was in Hawking's mind. In fact, he invoked a model with this picture. Okay, and that's pretty much, if not the holy grail, semi-holy grail for people in gravity working back reaction. Okay, because we want to know whether the black hole would completely evaporate, would have some remnants, or what happens to the information contained in them. Okay, and quoting Rick's first, remark, it's ostensibly, it's clearly a dynamical problem, okay? And we need non-equilibrium thermodynamics, if not non-equilibrium statistical mechanics, in order to address these information and end state issues. So it's a sort of a modest motivation for getting into this program. And I would pick out the work of Nasser, well, Bardeen certainly, most important. He used the Vaidya metric, which is a radiating black hole metric. I don't want to get to be too technical, but just give you a flavor of what's involved and what thermal view theory can contribute. And it's believed that this semi-classical formulation is valid at early times without Bragg reaction, okay, the test field calculation, which was what Stephen and many other people did to derive this formula. But at late times, M changes significantly, and the T mu nu may differ. Okay, and there is a controversy as to what size of black hole would begin to have fluctuations so strong as to destroy the semi-classical description. Okay, some people might say that, well, even what astrophysical solar mass size would be the problem. Some people would say that near the horizon, the fluctuation would disrupt that. Okay, and I think everybody agrees that when the size of a black hole is of Planck scale, new physics would set in. Okay, certainly Bragg reaction would be essential. Now let me give you one example of a fluctuation-dissipation relation description of semi-classical gravity. I skipped many transparencies. Amongst them is this statement that actually the semi-classical Bragg reaction is encapsulated by the fluctuation-dissipation relation. Okay. And we would like to try this also for the black hole, and I'll come to Emil's work in the next slide. But let's start with something a little bit earlier. Candelas and Sharma, very early on in the game, in fact, they proposed this idea, which I've always been indebted to all along. But unfortunately, this is not the right thing. Okay, I'll explain to you The idea is beautiful, okay, but the content is wrong. The energy flux transmitted across the horizon of a perturbed black hole, this is even from classical physics, 1971, Carter, Hawking, and Bardeen, let's say, is given in terms of the shear. You can see this is the change, right, in time and integrated over the spherical angle, and it's proportional to the shear squared. And this can be related to the horizon area, okay? And the horizon area in this way decreases with respect to the Van Snell coordinate. I didn't show you the slide which defines all these quantities, but you all know that. Horizon area decreases, and so one can generalize this classical relation to semi-classical by simply replacing this, let's say, by the operator with respect to the unruh state, because they want this to be a dynamical state. And Condylis and Sharma interpret this as a FDR, fluctuation dissipation reaction, relation. And they did it for the Kerr black hole, which essentially says that the dissipation in the area due to the Hawking process here, okay, is related to quantum fluctuations of gravitons. Because in here, you notice that the fluctuation of gravitons, okay, enters into the sigma. Right. There's a problem here, okay? Their FDR is not a truly statistical, it's not a fluctuation dissipation relation in a true statistical mechanical sense, okay? For such a relation, it should relate the dissipation of a certain quantity, and here the area, to the fluctuation of the same quantity. And indeed, one needs a two-point function of the area, okay, to be related to the change of the area. So if you talk about the dissipation of the area and try to relate it to the fluctuations of the area, it's actually a two-point function of the area, which can be translated to be a four-point function of the graviton field. Okay. First remark. Now let's look at something a little bit easier. That of a static black hole or quasi-static black hole in a box, sort of in equilibrium, in quasi-equilibrium with its own thermal radiation. This was studied, this problem of black reaction was studied by York in 1983. 86 and in the 90s throughout, and his collaborators, David Brown most notably. And in this way of approach, Emil very early on proposed this. Okay, fluctuation dissipation relation exists between the commutator and the anti-commutator of T mu nu. So Emil certainly did the right thing, right? It's the two-point function of the T mu nu. Right? But as probably Larry alluded to, this is sort of would be a natural extension if one takes a finite temperature field theory at heart, which of course we know with respect to the Hartle-Hawking vacuum. In this setup, we do have a thermal description of the black hole in equilibrium, in quasi-equilibrium with its Hawking radiation. Okay, and so you can take this thermal field theory and use linear response regime to come up with this, and Emil continue on and discuss some of the back reaction effects. You know, very beautiful paper, right? Now, but in order to move ahead, the reason why we didn't go venture into it is because we felt that something is missing. And let me tell you what is missing here. It's done in a test field case, okay? Because the thermal field is not changing, and the black hole is not changing. It's sitting there. And it's influenced by the thermal radiation. But it's not a dynamical back reaction, a full dynamical back reaction sense. You might question, look, I mean, this is a static situation. What do you mean a full dynamical back reaction? But as we know, as soon as you wanted to get a back reaction self-consistent solution, you would have to work with a slightly more general set of geometry as well as quantum states. Okay, so in other words, you can no longer stay in the test field case, what I call a rigid linear response, which amounts to assuming a fixed background geometry and, in this case, a thermal state. And there are a few other indications. The dissipation kernel should depend on the quantum state, even for free fields. However, in the test field, the dissipation kernel is given by the two-point commutator of the quantum field, which is independent of the quantum state of the free field. However, in a back reaction problem in semi-classical gravity, B is given by the two-point function of T mu nu or four-point function of the phi, and those depend on the quantum state. In other words, you really need to give it a little bit yield, okay, in order to look at how it responds. Otherwise, it's really just a rigid thing sitting there, acquiring all the nice thermal properties. So in order to do such a back reaction, one really needs to allow for the varying space-time, or at least one family of quasi-static geometry, as well as states deviating ever slightly, even though from the thermal state. All right, now, now we get into the really hot water part, the completely soaked part. Just as well, okay. So the program for us is really, there are two parts. Here is a black hole sitting in a thermal radiation in a box. It has to be enclosed in a box. The crucial part is really the fluctuations of the event horizon. Okay, some people think that the event horizon, like Kasher, Anglais, and there are two or three groups that think that that's going to be violent. The black hole event horizon will be violent, and that's going to lead to some interesting new physics. Larry Ford, and after our calculation here, are in an opposite viewpoint, that they are actually finite. They are significant, like of the order 1, okay, but it's not generating anything sensational or qualitatively different. It does indicate to us that that these quantities, the fluctuations, are actually very important physical quantities to probe into. So this touches on the last part of the talk, which I will flash through this very quickly. I won't talk about the horizon part because that's actually very involved, but I'll just, in the spirit of coming back home to thermal field theory, okay, show you a very quick summary. Ah, good. It's not that bad. A thermal plasma in the gravitational field. Okay. I think a good one third of the audience were in Brookhaven. Maybe I should call screen a lot more. I'll show you just five transparencies as allowed for by Pisarsky. Okay. The massless scalar field now, okay, in a linear gravity. So we have finally come down to Minkowski space. All right, this is Minkowski space, the perturbed H mu nu plus some form like structure here. And you can do it by perturbation theory because the green function, okay, is really with regard to the Minkowski space time. The only difference is now you have to do thermal field theory. So these are thermal green functions, and we all know how to do that via the CTP method. Too bad Rick is not here. I would like to keep showing these terms to them, to him, to make him happy. So they're all there. Tag along. And you can write down the CTP effective action. Boy, this is quite cross-grained, but I think that's only the background that's mute. So let me do a quick clean up. Is this better? Wow. Anyway, you all know this. So let me, the last part here is interesting. Well, of course, the in-in, you have double of that, right? Two of the in-in, but the in-out, the crucial difference is, of course, this term. You have the plus and the minus. Well, the plus and the minus right there, the V and then the V plus and so on. So this is the term that actually gives us the all the interesting things in terms of the noise and the fluctuations. And it's expressed in terms of the 14 tensor basis, which was worked out by Taylor and his group earlier on in the last decade, in fact. I won't show you these bases. Wipe them clean. But the interesting thing is the influence functional. Okay. Half of that is gone also. The influence action form, we want to cast the CTP into the influence function form to enable us to identify the noise and the dissipation kernel easily. Alright, here's the dissipation, here's the noise. These are the original Einstein-Hilbert action to order h squared. And the perfect fluid stress energy tensor, of course, we should still have, and this is the nice comfortable term that we all recognize in thermal fields. And the scalar, contribution of scalar fields to the thermal graviton polarization tensor. Larry, some of these things that you mentioned now come out. These were actually discovered by lots of people before us. In fact, Rieben and has done a lot of work, the Almeida, Frankel, Taylor, they've all done that. What we would like to show is that what they have done in linear response theory, okay, has only done half of the work, so to speak. There's not much dynamics going on, and there's also no fluctuation or noise contributions. I'm running out of space to dry these things. So, but if you do it via the influence functional, you would get the dissipation as well as the noise kernel. And there's a dissipation fluctuation relation governing that. This is for thermal field in a perturbed background space-time, which is adequate only as a far field limit for the black hole back reaction case. Okay, this is far field. We're working on two different regimes, and they're completely different, like day and night. And the relation here, oh, let's throw them away. So last two transparencies, I want to show you the relation of this approach, using this example to illustrate the relation of the functional approach with the linear response, which of course is a very long established, you know, very neat way of doing things. And you can see that indeed at the end, the linear response, you can start out with, let's say, a source term or a current term, and then a displacement in the configuration variable. And at the end, you would get the Tmu nu fluctuation tensor. And what we're adding here, of course, is that you can actually get all these things from the influence functional in one line. The derivation of the influence function, of course, is not just in one line. These two are related to each other intimately, again, from the fluctuation dissipation relation. Most important of all, of course, now we are doing dynamics. The whole formalism is set up to do dynamics, and hence one would be able to come up with an Einstein-Langevin equation. Rather busy cleaning up along the way. And you can see with the same prescription, you get this equation, which is driven by the noise term in there, right? So in other words, if you take the influence functional, you get everything people have obtained from linear response theory, the dissipation kernel, the polarization tensor, and what is more, you'll get the noise tensor as well. You'll get the dynamical equation. This, of course, is after all the most important part, because that will enable you to run the dynamics. All right, let me conclude. As for the black hole part, one could do quite a few things. Thermal field in Robson-Walker universe is just a simple generalization away. I love to come back to Gross, Perry, and Yaffe at some point. It's not a trivial problem at all, because I need to understand tunneling in a real-time sense. That's another sort of thing in my mind for over 15 or 20 years. Anybody has some good suggestion, most welcome. Because only then we would be able to talk a little bit more about statistical mechanics, thermal, beyond equilibrium conditions. And it's not an easy problem at all. Nucleation, tunneling with dissipation, I've mentioned all those. And the nucleation of black holes from hot flat space. That's related also to, of course, it's a central issue in Euclidean quantum gravity, after Larry's work with David. There's also work by Stephen Hawking's group using the conformal Euclidean quantum gravity approach. In a larger context, the summary is that in semi-classical gravity, Bragg reaction is encapsulated in a fluctuation dissipation relation. The dissipation in terms of the mass loss, well, this is, wait, yes, this is again with respect to the black hole situation. And the static space-time, we've mentioned that dynamical space-time, I didn't delve into it at all. And the hope is that now, using this scheme, you can have an Einstein-Langevin equation to play with. And also because of the noise and fluctuation term derived from first principle, you could also safely use those to study possible phase transitions at the Planck scale, since PL was used for plasma. So this is the Planck scale, and connect with string theory, hopefully, in terms of collective state excitations. Thank you for your patience.